Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins, and I'm sitting here with my colleague Mark Pringle.
Hello, Barney.
Hello, Mark. We are going to be talking in this podcast about Nico, Bobby Womack, and everything that's new on Rocks Back Pages this coming week. But first, it gives me enormous pleasure to be able to introduce and welcome Amy Linden.
Hello. I just flew in from Istanbul, and boy, are my arms tired.
Amy, it's lovely to have you here. You've stopped by this office a couple of times in the past.
Yeah.
We weren't even doing a podcast then. When we knew you were going to be in town, we had to have you,
as a
guest. Because
I always enjoy coming by.
Well, you're just great fun, and we always end up having great fun talking with you. So why don't we get rolling by asking you how you came to be a music writer in the first place? I mean, you are heavily associated with Black American music of all stripes and hues. Let me rephrase
Hughes,
that.
Hughes, yeah.
Yeah.
You are, light skin, high yellow, you are, people who are like biracial, yeah, all the Hughes.
I'll get me coach.
Yeah, it's quite
that's definitely staying in.
Hughes Corporation, everything.
Hughes Corporation.
Yeah.
I'm definitely getting me coach.
Yeah.
You have written a lot for magazines, like you wrote for Vibe, you wrote for The Source, you've written for Rolling Stone, you've written for New York Times, and you've written brilliantly about all kinds of great music. How did you come to be writing about music in the first place?
Well, it's when I was a kid, I always liked music and I always liked to write. But when I was a kid in junior high and high school, at our public library, I would sit there and just kill time in the library, and I would read Cream, and I would read all these old rock magazines, and I just thought they were really cool, and I would read all this stuff like Charles M. Young and Jan Uhelski and all these people.
Yeah.
And who, when I found out was a girl, I was like, oh my God, like, this is so cool, because I assumed it was a boy. Anyway, I moved to San Francisco in the late 70s when I got out of high school with the idea that I'd stay there for a year and then go to college, which that didn't happen. So I kind of fell in with the punk scene there. I saw the Sex Pistols last show, which was, like, really fucking dope. You can curse on this, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Absolutely.
It was really fucking dope. But that expression didn't exist in 1978, but it was really cool. And the punk scene in San Francisco was kind of small. I mean, so you would see the same people at every show. And there was a magazine, newspaper starting up called Damage. And to be honest with you, I don't even know how I got connected with them, but I started doing reviews for them. We didn't get paid, but the first article I ever did was an interview with the Cramps. It was like Brian Gregory's one of his last shows. And then I interviewed Butch Tetras, and I interviewed Gang of Four, actually, which was really cool. And then I moved back to New York and was just kind of doing whatever you do in New York. I was working at an after-hours hardcore punk club.
What year is this, roughly?
What year was John Lennon killed?
80. December 80.
Okay, so I moved back like right when he was killed, and I knew that maybe I'd been in the punk scene for a little too long, because I was like, whatever.
I mean, an appropriate punk response.
Yeah, I was
to
like,
the death
I
of
mean,
John.
You know, whatever. It's sad. Life goes on.
Darby Crash had just died.
Darby Crash had just died, and I was supposed to interview. I was supposed to interview him, and the motherfucker died. I was like, oh, I really wanted to interview the Germs, because I'd never seen them. But anyway, long story short, I come back to New York, and then I start kind of writing a little bit. I was hanging out with bands. I was, you know, not in a kind of hanging out with bands. I mean, I was hanging out in a productive way with bands.
Is there a production?
Well, I don't know. I had come back because I was from the... They thought I was from the West Coast, which I'm not. I'm from New York. But these bands were like, oh my God, you know Black Flag? Oh my God, you know these bands?
Yeah.
Oh my God, oh my God. And I'm like, sure, kids. You know? Anyway, and then in like 85 or 86... I became friends with this girl who wrote for Spin, and she kind of introduced me to John Leland, who's like the greatest guy ever, the nicest guy ever, great
than
writer.
Us. Yeah. Greater than us.
In the American version. And he was working at Spin, and I did a story about celebrity tattoos, celebrities who had tattoos, which back then you literally seriously had to think about it.
Like, yeah.
Who has a tattoo? And it's actually how I got my first tattoo.
Now you have to think about the ones that don't have
Now it's like obligatory. And then John, I had met this girl, again, it's always I met this girl in my neighborhood who was friends with Boogie Down Productions.
Uh-huh.
And I went over and I kind of knew who they were and I mentioned it to John. He goes, holy shit. Do you know them? And I went, I don't know them, but I met him. And she goes, you got to do a story about the Boogie Down Productions Juice Crew battle, which I'm going to pretend I knew more about, which I did, but I really didn't. I kind of knew about it, but I didn't. Anyway, so I went to interview Boogie Down Productions, and then Scott LaRock was killed like a week later, which was awful. And then bibbidi bobbidi boo. You know?
Right.
Did you always like black music?
I didn't really want to write about hip hop. Not that I wasn't a fan, but I felt like the world, you know, like I wasn't in the scene.
Yeah,
I
really
wasn't like hanging out. I mean, New York at that point in the early 80s, it was all everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But like I didn't go to the Roxy just because I was always, I don't know, something always came up. I didn't go to the Roxy, whatever. But I am like the only person of my age who lived in New York who never went to Danceteria. I went to the old Danceteria and then went to the new Danceteria for reasons I don't even remember why. I'm sure they were stupid. But yeah, I mean, I grew up in, you know, I grew up with Top 40 Radio.
Right.
So, of course,
yeah.
My first bicycle was named Jermaine after Jermaine Jackson. I'm not trying to be like all kumbaya, but it wasn't like, I mean, there was an urban station in New York. It was like WWRL or something that. But it was just like everybody danced to Motown. Everybody. But in high school, mm-hmm. I was voted most likely to appear on Soul Train. Because I was a dandy dancer in my youth. But yeah, it wasn't like a stretch for me. I mean, I always grew up with that stuff. I had a lot of friends, you know, some of my best friends were black. and it was just sort of like something, I hated the Grateful Dead, you know, I just fucking hated the Grateful Dead.
Oops.
Why?
Dang it.
Oh, well, it's all right. I just hated them. And I listened to everything, I just hated them, you know. And so, yeah, well, I mean, what were you going to listen to?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
I mean, what were you going to listen to?
I mean, you're talking about the days when Top 40 Radio played black and white music.
It played everything.
And that's before FM, which initially seemed like a really good idea, ended up splitting everything into its component parts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was same here, but if you grew up in the New... I mean, I'm sure it was everywhere, but if you grew up in New York, there were a couple of radio stations, WABC, WCBS, and, you know, and they just played everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it wasn't like something you go, and now here's the latest song from some black guy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like, it just was.
Yeah.
I mean, we would sit there and do dance routines
mm-hmm.
to, you know, Thin Line Between Love and Hate. We had these intricate dance routines.
Fantastic.
That we done. Thin Line, we would draw the thin line and then make the love and then make the hate. You know, I mean, you just did that.
It's a thin line between love and hate.
One of my favorite things to do in high school was to, like, smoke a lot of weed with my loser boyfriend, and we would watch the Knicks with the volume off playing P-Funk.
Excellent.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, yeah. That'll do.
Yeah.
One of the pieces that we've selected for the spotlight on you on the homepage this week is, inevitably, it has to be the interview that you did with Amy Winehouse. Now, the bizarre thing is, I happen to be, you may not even remember this, but I met you just after you'd interviewed
yes,
her.
Yes, at Book Soup.
We were on
Sunset. Is
that
what it's called, Book Soup?
Yeah, it was Book Soup.
We're Fawn Hall.
Doing an event there.
Fawn
and you came
Hall
in.
Was the receptionist.
Was she?
Yes.
What, that night?
She worked as the clerk there. Because I kept
how
looking
bizarre.
At her like,
that was
where
Fawn
do I know
Hall.
This chick? Where
why
do I know
I
this
know
chick?
That? Well, anyway, you walked in and you said, I've just interviewed Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
And she was
supposed to do two shows in L.A.
I had a ticket for Spaceland the
and
following
she canceled.
Night. And she canceled.
Yeah, she was supposed to do... She had already played New York. She had already done her American debut, which I was at Joe's Pub. And then she was supposed to do two shows in L.A. She did the Roxy.
She did do the Roxy.
And then she was supposed to play that
she
next...
She canceled Spaceland.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first time I...
But so, I mean, look, it's
we had talked on the phone because you called me up out of the blue once, asked me if I knew how to get health insurance.
Me?
Yes, did you called me up and goes, oh, I was wondering, because you have a kid and I'm trying to get health insurance for my
family.
Yeah,
no,
like,
I remember having to pay health insurance.
But when you find out, let me know.
Yeah, no, it was like $400 a month at that time.
Oh, that's nothing.
But so, Amy, not just because she's called Amy, but it's irresistible.
Oh my God.
Amy chasing Amy. You just interviewed Amy. How do you remember that interview? Given she was about to become huge in America.
You
got in there pretty early.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was funny because they had... Originally, they, being the record label, had asked me to do the bio for Frank, before Back to Black, you know, because I was like, oh, yeah. I got it. She's good. Because I always used to do bios for black artists, and I used to go, I do listen to white people. And then they sent this. I went, oh, my God, this is so obvious why they're sending this to me. And then they never released Frank. And there was a gossip columnist in the United States named Perez Hilton.
Oh, yes.
Who's a really nasty queen. Mm. Like, a really fucking nasty queen. I mean, he's gotten bad. But he was a huge... He had fantastic taste in music. And he was on her, like, early on. And I used to read, and I started getting into her. So I had seen her at Joe's Pub. And
we have that review.
And I swear it was like the John Landau, I have seen the future of rock and roll moves. And because Joe's Pub is, like, tiny. It's a cabaret. And as I said in my review, like, basically the people that were there, it was industry people and people who couldn't understand why Craig David wasn't a huge star in the United States. So, and then rap, you know, Jay-Z.
Jay-Z was there, the second show.
We didn't get Jay-Z at my show. I had Sizz and Cope and Mark Ronson was there. And, you know, but Mos Def, who was a good friend of hers.
Yes.
But, so she was like, had done that remix with Ghostface.
Yes.
Which was really getting play, actually. I mean, people liked it.
That was You Know I'm No Good.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, because history has proven, at least the history of my world, that black folk are going to check for a white artist way before a white artist is going to check for a black artist. White fans. They're just like, if you show that you're there to do the work and you're not pandering, they're there. You know, people are there.
When I first lay eyes on you, temperature so hot, the heat just rise with you. Let me ride with you, talk about your mistakes. You cheated yourself, but these are the breaks, and it'll never be the same.
But anyway, so, yes, I was going to interview her for a black magazine, for a hip-hop magazine, actually, for XXL had a little R&B.
The hip-hop soul.
Yeah, a little offshoot that they did. And they were into her. And they also liked her because she was supposedly out of control. And, you know, that she was punching people out, and this was cool. So I was kind of expecting the worst, not the worst, but I thought this could be, she could be a piece of work. And so we met at the Chateau Marmont, which is, you know, riddled with history, obviously. And she comes out, and she was a little late, but again, I've been dealing with hip-hop artists for a long time. You know, if you're within 2 days of the interview,
we're doing well.
Yeah. And... Well, I'm tall, but she was tiny. Yeah. I have never seen anybody who wasn't a child that tiny. I'm not even being kidding. And she was like the size of one of my legs. And she was all kind of, she had obviously just woken up. And, you know, she could kind of tell that she was being observed as to what she was going to be doing. Like, the writer's going to say, she had a drink. You know, or something like that. And she did have a drink, but...
Amaretto sour.
Like, who drinks that?
Amy.
Yeah. It was just like... Anyway, she was very sweet. She was very hesitant. And she only really kind of came a lot... Not that she was a bad interview. She was a really good interview. But she only really came out of this morass of self-hatred. Of self... wasn't even self-effacing. It was just like she didn't like herself when she talked about her music. And when she talked about her music and she talked about singing and she, when she talked about the records, like the jazz records she wanted to make, then she was like bigger than life. But when she was talking about herself and talking about her relationships or talking about men in particular, she was like, yeah, you know I'm no good. You know, I'm a piece of shit. I'm this and that, you know. And I remember just leaving there, just wanting to, like, put her in bubble wrap.
Yeah.
And just go, oh, my God. Yeah. Like, oh, my God. And it was just crazy. It was just crazy because, you know, I mean, you're not there to become friends with the artist at all. I mean, you're there to do your job, and they know that. And, you know, obviously you want to be nice. You want to be pleasant. But everyone was like, oh, my God, what was she like? Was she a bitch? Did she, like, threaten you? Was she doing this? Was she that? I said, no. Like, I seriously wanted to take this girl out for, like, a sandwich and just say, it's going to be okay. Like, you're going to be okay. And then
which unfortunately wouldn't have been the truth.
Not at all. I mean, you know, she had, like, a horrible combination of, like, shitty taste in men, mental illness, and money. know?
Right, and sudden explosive
fighting. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, she was massive.
And she was just on the cusp of that.
Well, the LA show, like, Courtney Love was at the show.
Yeah.
It's like mess, like, oh, that's how you're a mess. That's how you're a mess if you can actually sing. I get it, you know? But it was really kind of, what really hit me was like, okay, so the New York show was, the album had not yet been released, or was about to be released. And, you know, to me, Rehab is her weakest song.
I'm not a huge fan. I mean, no, I'm No Good is like 10 times the record.
Yeah, no, and Back to Black, I mean, it'll rip your heart out. Oh, you know, God. Rip your heart out. But Rehab is like, it's a great song, it's fine, but it's sort of like the Joan Osborne, it's like, What If God Were One of Us? It's not her kind of best song, though it's a good song. By the time she hit L.A., people were knowing her, and they were like, Rehab, you know.
It was tiresome, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then by the time she hit New York again, it was done for. She was totally, like, couldn't finish the show. Mm.
It was so really sad.
It was really sad. I just want to say one thing, and it's, I mean, Mark is a great guy and he's a great producer, but Salaam Remy always gets overlooked.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I had no idea until I saw the second Amy movie, which is much more about the music than the first Amy movie.
Okay.
And the second one, suddenly I realised that actually basically half of this album he produced.
Salaam did it.
You know, and I think what was good in terms of, you know, Mark Ronson did a very good job. And actually Mark Ronson mixed it, and I believe he mixed it. What he did, which was really clever, is he made their productions indistinguishable from one another.
Yeah.
That they sounded completely
No, it doesn't sound like two guys.
It doesn't.
No, but when they released that Outtakes record, the Lioness record, Salaam hosted the listening session. Mm-hmm. He's a nice guy, first off, and I've interviewed him before, and he's an interesting guy, actually. But his, like, one of his aunts or his sister is, like, a big soca singer. But, I mean, you could see how painful it was for him to talk about it. But Salaam doesn't seek the limelight. Salaam is also not as good a story.
Mm-hmm.
He's also not an artist in the sense that he's out there doing whatever he does. I mean, I like Mark as a person. I'm not taking anything away from Mark. He's a really good producer. He's a nice guy the few times I've met him. But I just always feel like Salaam also did that.
Yeah.
You know, and Salaam produced the records that influenced Amy. Like, he produced the Fugees record, you know, and...
I mean, to be fair, in the film, the documentary, he gets his due.
That's
what
I'm saying. Yeah. The first time I really became aware of how central
and
he was.
And comes across really well.
He comes across
such
great.
A sweet
yeah, yeah.
guy.
But I just I just sometimes feel bad, like...
Well, because it's partly because Mark Ronson is an artist in his own right.
And also a really good self-promoter.
Yeah, he is.
No, he is. And maybe he's just like, which is fine. I mean, it's not to take it, but I always just almost feel like I always have to, remind people that Salaam Remy produced half of that record.
Yeah, that's right. Amy, you've interviewed so many other great stuff. Everybody, baby. Everybody. You know, Missy Elliott, Kanye West. Tell us a little bit about Kanye, because we're probably going to feature the Kanye piece.
Oh, Dios mio. Where do we start? All right. So, I was assigned by Complex Magazine, which was kind of like a music magazine, but it was kind of beginning to fashion itself after, like, the Lads Mags. So, they were going to do Kanye, Talib Kweli, and the Beasties, right? It was like three stories. They were all going to be on the cover. Okay. So, they were doing it at this big photo... some photo studio. And they were all going to be there. I was going to do the interview.
This is like 2004, right? College Dropout hasn't even come out at this point.
Right. It was correct? About to come out. It was 2004. Okay. So I knew who he was, you know, because he had done a lot of production. I thought he was a great producer. And Through the Fire or Through the Wire, whatever the hell it was called, had come out.
Through the Wire.
Right. So my son, who was, I don't know, junior high or something like that at that point. He was a big hip-hop fan, really like Kanye. And he was going to, you know, he was going to buy the bootleg or something like that. And I said, yeah, I'll get the record. You don't have to fucking buy the bootleg. You know, they're going to send me the record. I'm interviewing him, right? So I meet Kanye. I meet him through his publicist. He was just, oh my God, he was fucking a nightmare. And the publicist goes, oh, this is Amy. She's going to be doing the interview, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I really liked the record, which was true. I really did like the record. And he goes, oh, did you buy it? Okay. And I looked at him and I went, no. I said, I didn't buy the record. I said, they send us the records. I didn't buy the record. And he was like, oh, this is, you know, oh, I'm not doing this interview. I'm like, I said, well, if it makes you feel any better.
I did buy the record.
No. I said, if it makes you feel any better, my son was going to buy a bootleg, and I told him not to buy the bootleg. So, in essence, I saved you money because my kid was going to buy a fucking bootleg, and you wouldn't have gotten that $5 anyway, and I wouldn't have paid for the record, so we're even. And I said it, like, in a funny way, and he's ready to walk off. So the publicist is like, oh, you know, Amy's, she's got a sense of humor. She's got sort of a dark sense of humor. She's really great. You love her, blah, blah, blah. All right.
That's what we tell people about you.
Yeah, well, I'm adorable. But, I mean, it's just like, and I'm just sitting there going, dude, okay, really, did you buy the record? Have you, no. You know, that's what that for promotional use on the fucking record means, you morons. So I'm like, all right, whatever. So I interviewed Talib, nice guy, you know, well-respected, great guy, blah, blah, blah. Then I interviewed the Beasties, who are sort of new from, like, back in the day. And also, at that point, I was sort of starting to vaguely date someone Beastie-affiliated. So it hadn't we hadn't really started dating yet, but he was Beastie affiliated.
That's the best line in the podcast so far. I was vaguely starting to date someone who was vaguely Beastie affiliated.
Well, to hear him tell it, he's completely, you know. But anyway, we were just starting to get together. So we had that kind of conversation and stuff like that. And then, so they were great and they were funny and they're the Beasties and they're pros and, you know, whatever. Yeah. And then I had an interview with Kanye. All right, so Kanye was the first. You had to wait because he had to get his shape up. It was like, okay, I understand that. You know what a shape up is?
No. We looked bewildered.
It's a black term. It's when your hair is being, black guys, you know, you're getting the haircut. You're shaping it up. You're getting shape up.
Time to get a shape up.
But it's not like a haircut. It's like a more a maintenance.
At least I got her to shape up, though.
Yeah. It's a maintenance.
Oh, so cruel.
There are many, many, I have done many an interview where the interview is being done during the shape up. Just a little, a fixing. Okay, so we had to wait for that because his barber, you know, his barber was coming and it's like, all right, so anyway, so we go and I go do the interview and he's just, first off, he wouldn't look directly at me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would sort of kind of this. And he just would start going off on these tangents. Like, he was furious because Rolling Stone had given the record 4.5 stars, and he had gotten the Boys Choir of Harlem to come all the way out to the Hamptons to record, and why didn't they acknowledge the effort he had put into getting them to come to the Hamptons? And I'm thinking, you don't get fucking points for, like, driving a choir out to the Hamptons. First off, who brings the Boys Choir of Harlem out to the Hamptons? Why don't you just bring your ass into Harlem? Number one. Number two, whatever. Like, you don't get scored on the effort points. Anyway, long story short. So he was just a dick.
Yeah.
So basically he was like Donald Trump even then.
He was just a dick. I mean, and the thing is, I left there. And then you start reading all these other reviews, like some thinking, maybe he was a dick because I'm a girl. Maybe he's a dick because sometimes rappers go, ugh, the white writer? They sent the white writer? Really? Like, we're not worthy of, like, getting the black writer? And then I'm like, every review, he's a dick. He's a dick. Yeah. He's a dick. Yeah. He's a dick.
Yeah.
It wasn't even like he's crazy.
Mm.
I mean, crazy you can deal with. He was just a dick.
It's so disappointing because, I mean, those first couple of albums, I think, are fantastic
records.
They
are.
Yeah.
I was checking for him up until Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, and I was like, we're done.
Yeah.
It lost me.
We're done. You know, like recently, him chumming up with Donald Trump, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ.
I mean, I just think he's one of these people who thinks being a provocateur for the sake of being a provocateur. And, I mean, I don't want to, his mental illness is not something to joke around about. No, he indeed is bipolar, that's really sad, that's effed up. But the thing is, he could be talking about it in a positive way to get people to talk about mental illness, but then he just, it all doesn't matter. I know a lot of crazy people.
Yeah.
They're not dicks.
No. No.
I don't know whether Kanye's ever sampled Bobby Womack, but we're going to just roll back in time to the audio interview.
It's your boy Kanye to the... Got consequences ahead.
I see now.
Little brother.
I see now.
Yeah. I want y'all to listen.
Let you through, boy.
It's 5 years since Bobby Womack died. So we're just marking
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
It was just last week, but then Elliot Roberts died and yada, yada, yada. So this is marking 5 years. Mark, tell us about the first clip from this 1976
Before we get to the clip, going to sort of some of the rest of the... It's Cliff White, classic Cliff White interview, which isn't really an interview. It's a kind of rambling conversation. That's what Cliff did as a journalist. And it would produce really great copy as a result, you know. It starts off with Bobby playing guitar, singing a song. He's in a hotel room, I guess. He's just played his British debut show at the Hammersmith Odeon, which hadn't gone very well. Mm. And so there's a bit of a post-mortem going on about the show.
That's around the corner, right?
It's very close.
Okay.
And in fact, I went through I posted one of the reviews a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
and
a good review.
And I glanced at a couple of the other reviews, and they're all mixed, including Vivian Goldman, who's a huge Bobby Womack fan. And so they're sort of talking about that, and it's fairly rambling stuff. But then he gets on to this thing about, you know, Cliff asks him, you know, do you get flack from the black disc jockeys, particularly about using white musicians? So that's this clip right now.
Everybody claims that they want the best things out of life. But not everyone, wanna go.
Do you get any stick from black jocks because you've been working with so many white musicians now and got such a white following?
I started playing muscle shows, and like none of the jocks knew that none of those guys, they didn't know nothing about muscle shows. They thought all those guys were black. They did. They really thought they were black until they were telling me, like, what do you think about, we were doing an interview one time, they said, what do you think about all these white guys trying to steal our music, like, you know, so like, listen to your music, you know, and we listened to Aretha Franklin, listened to Joe Jackson and all these people, like, he said, they're trying to get it, but they didn't know that the guys on the, I said, well, all those guys on the session is white, they said, like, oh, man, shocking. I said, no, it's you know, they were really like, oh, man, I can't believe it. They haven't stole it, they got it. I said, no, man, it's not like that. I said, just like you like certain kind of foods and you'd be surprised. I said, when you go in the southern cities, like in the south, you see white people eating cornbread and greens and buttermilk and they raise up on that stuff. I said, they raise up on that stuff, man. That's all they know. And I said, then you go, you come to L.A. and don't nobody want to eat up a steak and baked potato. They don't have vegetables, man. They don't even deal with that. They don't even deal with greens. They don't even eat pork. They don't eat anything but, you know, cottage cheese and stuff like that. Bagels, lots of bagels.
Everybody help me sing the song. It's just kind of pretty interesting stuff. He sort of carries on. He talks about his most recent album, Safety Zone, which is actually recorded in LA, about how much he hates that album. Apparently, all his guitar parts were taken off. Mm. It was completely mixed without his...
It's a terrible record.
It's a not good record. He talks about touring, goes back to talk about the London show. Great story about sacking a horn player, which is highly amusing. Great story about getting off a record label he's on by threatening the owner with a blank pistol.
Ah, yes.
And we'll play a clip at the end of the show, which is about how basically he recorded an album for Atlantic where his vocals were taken off and Wilson Pickett's were substituted.
You lie!
Well, that's what Bobby says, you know.
Maybe some truth in that.
Maybe some truth.
Oh,
yeah.
My God, that's the funniest thing.
Yeah. And it was actually the nice thing about that interview.
They don't sound anything alike.
He does a great two-word impersonation from Wexler. He said, I rang up Wexler, said, you know, what's happening to my album? And he said, coming out soon, baby.
Baby, yeah. And Wexler did call people baby.
Baby all the
especially
time.
Especially black people.
Yeah, it's a great interview. I mean, we are huge Womack fans.
Oh,
when I was in a band, I spent about 3 years trying to rewrite the first two songs on Poet 2 and not succeeding. I mean, just a massive Womack fan.
Yeah.
It's great to hear him talking in that era because we do have...
He does sound a bit refreshed, doesn't he? He's got like... He's had a drink and maybe a joint.
He was already at this point, of course, hanging out with the Stones.
Yes.
So, you know, Ronnie Wood was his kind of... was his all-night kind of
man.
Buddy, you know. But, you know, he's always charming, and even though it's quite hard to understand what he's saying sometimes...
Oh, my God.
Because he's just...
transcribing Bobby Womack.
Well, exactly. It's not easy.
But he's, I think he's charming, but you know he would cut you in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
I mean, I've
interviewed him a couple of times and gotten well with him. Loved his music, and I love the fact that he was a different kind of soul star. Yeah. Really, he wasn't like even like a Marvin Gaye.
Right.
He was like this kind of singer songwriter guy.
No, totally.
Who happened to be incredibly soulful.
In that sense, close to like Bill Withers or someone.
A little bit closer to Bill Withers. I mean, he'd come out of gospel. He'd come out of the Valentinos. And initially quite orthodox soul stuff that he did. But when, I think after he started hanging out with the Stones and other people like that, Jim Ford, Sly Stone, of course Sly was a massive influence. Those two albums, Communication and Understanding, that he talks about in this audio, were like, almost like, they were like singer-songwriter albums.
And really great records. I also love the fact that he became his stepdaughter's father-in-law.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Which just gets very, very complicated.
No, I like a messy artist.
Yeah.
He was messy. He was all over the shop, really. Yeah. But
me and my boyfriend in high school, our songs, we had two songs because we were so in love.
Let me guess.
Woman's
Gonna Have It.
No, God, I was in high school. I was 16. This is the same boyfriend I was smoking weed and watching and listening to P-Funk to. Tavares, Only Takes a Minute to Fall in Love. And When There's a Will, There's a Way.
Oh, yeah. Nice. I enjoyed this interview. It's quite hard to make out what he's saying.
For what it's worth, I interviewed Marky Smith once, and I didn't understand a fucking word he said. I thought the tape was backwards. I was like, this tape, and I just made it up.
Well, funny you should mention Marky Smith, because we can segue just briefly into a little discussion about Nico. I met Nico a couple of times. One was with Marky Smith. What are you trying to say?
No, I was going to say, do you want me to tell my Womack story?
Oh,
Come, tell us your Womack story.
Okay, it's really quick. Okay, so huge fan. You know, I just love him. Okay, so I interviewed Resurrection for the New York Times, which I thought was a good record. I don't care if you guys think it was a good record. I thought it was a good record. I'm assuming you didn't. Did you like it?
I can't even remember it, to be honest with you.
It's good. I liked it. Anyway, long story short, I get a call from somebody at the New York Times. And they're like, we received a phone call for you, but we didn't want to give out, it's way before cell phones, we didn't want to give out your phone number, but he wanted you to have his number, and he wanted you to call him. And I'm like, who is it? And they go, oh, it's Bobby Womack. And I'm like, yeah, right. And I'm like, all right, sure, I'll play this game. So I call him, and it's fucking Bobby Womack. And I'm talking to him. And he's like, oh, baby, I just want to say, you know, I really like, this is my all-purpose old black eye singer voice. I do the same voice for James Brown. I do the same voice for everybody. But it's like, oh, I just want to say that, you know, I really dug it, you know, the review was like really good. You know, I was sitting there, with Ronnie and Keith. And I'm like, and I'm in the back of my mind, I'm going, he's Ronnie Wood, right? Keith Richards, right? Oh, man, I'm talking to Bobby Womack, and he's hanging out with Ronnie Wood. Anyway, so that was like, and then I did get to see him before he passed at City Winery, and he was, you know, he had to sit, and he had the lyrics in front of him. But I'm really glad I got to see him, and I took my son, and as the show's going on, my kid's on the phone, and I'm like going, put your fucking phone away. But then he said he was Googling the samples, because he's like, I know this song.
Well, shazamming it.
Yeah. No. He was like, oh, I know the song. Who sampled this? And then I got to meet, I very rarely like want a picture with the celebrity.
Yeah.
But it was Bobby Womack. Yeah. And I was just,
That last album, Damon Albarn's done some good stuff and some stuff I really can't stand, but I thought they did a really good job with him on that last album.
No, but that wasn't Damon Albarn's
It was mainly
Richard Russell.
That was a good record.
I thought it was terrific.
Damon had some input into it.
Yeah. But I will say that I interviewed Bobby Womack around that time or when he was doing with the Gorillaz. He told me he had no fucking idea who the Gorillaz were. It was like his son said, Dad, you should do this, man. The young white kids, they like that kind of music. And he's like, check?
Yeah.
And then he ended up killing it with him. But he, you know.
Yeah, there's a track called Cloud of Unknowing on the Gorillaz album, which is, it's beautiful.
And Stylo. It's a great song.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful, yeah. And that led to this kind of extraordinary swan song album, which
yeah.
is,
no, it's a beautiful
know, Please
record.
Forgive My Heart, that track is it's so heartbreaking.
It is lovely. Oddly, about 10 years before that, he'd tried to do the same, done a similar thing with Ray and Christian, and that hadn't worked.
Ray and Christian? I actually have a Ray and Christian
well,
record.
So do I. Oh. And he cut about 3 or 4 tracks with them, yes. with the idea of doing a whole album. They just didn't get on. I don't think he understood their Manchester accents and so on and so forth.
That would be
know.
A problem.
A bit like you with Marky Smith,
well,
you know.
Yeah.
So well, he sounds like Yosemite Sam. So, like, Yosemite Sam meets Yosemite Sam. Yeah. They're not going to understand
yeah.
each other.
Yeah, that's right.
But,
yeah.
but it's very similar to that the last album.
Oh, okay.
It really is. It's actually, they're very good. There's 2 or 3 tracks which are really, really worth listening to. Back to Nico.
Well, so yeah, where I was trying to go with Marky Smith was that the 2 times I met Nico, one was with I was interviewing Marky Smith, I think we were in Birmingham. Nico was the support act. So it was the fall of Nico. So I met her then.
Get it, the fall, Nico. Sorry.
Yeah. And the second time was with John Cooper Clarke when she was living in Brixton. And one of the pieces about Nico, so basically, next week in Manchester, this thing called the Nico Project opens. I think it's like two, maybe 3 weeks. And Maxine Peake, who's now, you know, a very respected actress in the UK, is part of this thing, the Nico Project. So we just thought we'd just focus a little bit on Nico. I just chose 3 pieces, one of which mentions this flat in Brixton, which she was sharing with John Cooper Clarke. But the first piece, 1965, so it's pre-Velvet.
Oh, wow.
It's pre-Marble Index, it's pre-everything. She's in London, living in Earl's Court, signed to Immediate Records,
yeah.
Andrew Lou Goldham's label. And she just says some hilarious things. She said, I have a habit of leaving places at the wrong time, but this time I'm determined to stay put in Earl's Court. Well, that didn't last very long. And then she says some of the hilarious things. If I wasn't modeling or singing, because she was German born, she was a model. She'd right. been in La Dolce Vita. She said, if I wasn't modeling or singing, I think I'd like to be a farmer or possibly captain of a ship. But you have to sort of say, I'd like to be a farmer right. or possibly captain of a ship. The next piece that we have is a long Lester Bangs, really, really eloquent piece about these extraordinary solo albums that Nico produced after mm-hmm. leaving. John Cale produced the Marble Index, which, I mean, love it or loathe it, and it's an acquired taste. It's certainly one of the most extraordinary records ever made, I think. And Desert Shore is not far behind. Lester says, you know, that the second side of the Marble Index, the 3 songs constitute one of the furthest outposts on the borderline of that vast pan-idiomatic musical language promised tomorrow.
Jiggle what?
It was out there. Oh, okay. That's my translation. It was out Sorry. There, and it is really out there. But it's good. And then the last piece is actually an interview that Nico did in Australia with Clinton Walker.
Oh, this is the one that Tammy oh. Faye Starlight does.
Oh, is it? Really?
She
really?
Reproduces that interview.
No.
No, it is... Okay. Hilarious.
Okay, so just explain briefly who Tammy Faye is.
Oh my God, Tammy Faye Starlight.
A Nico impersonator, right?
Well, no, she does more than that. Tammy Faye Starlight started out like as a sort of, she's a singer. She lives in, I think, Jersey or New York, and she's been around for a while, and she's a cabaret artist, and she has certain personas. She has done Marianne Faithfull, like the whole Broken okay. English record, but the thing is, she's a great singer. She is yeah. a better singer than Nico and Marianne Faithfull.
Okay.
And she often has Barry Reynolds playing with her.
Who is Marianne's guy.
Yeah, right. But not only does she do the album, she's hilarious. Mm. So she does these sort of bits. And so she does Nico. She does. But she like, I told you the jizz, you know. And it's just like she's really, and she's very, very funny. So she does whole albums, but she did the Nico, that interview.
That is extraordinary.
And she looks like, she looks nothing like her.
Okay.
But then she looks like
her. But she channels her.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, she has the blonde, but she's a great singer, but she just did all the Stones records, too. Okay. She just did Satanic Majesty.
Sounds great.
No, she is great. But anyway, that's...
It's a great interview, and you really get this sense of it. It's Bondi Beach, but all the curtains are closed.
Right.
There's incense burning. Nico's wearing leather.
I remember, it's really good.
And she just does classic Nico quotes. And I think Clinton asks, what would give you joy? To give shelter to a murderer on the run.
We've got one interview.
She does that interview.
Yeah. That's amazing. You're going to have to hear that.
In 71, I think, this Michael Watts, she predicts her own death. She says, I will go back to Ibiza to die.
Yeah. She was a dark
spirit. She's the only thing that makes Jackson Browne cool. Because, I mean, he's written some good songs, but as far as I'm concerned, I mean, he's written some great songs, but...
I've been out walking. I don't do too much talking these days.
That's Nico, the Nico Project, and three great pieces.
And of course,
about
our
her.
Previous guest, Jennifer Ross Bickerdike,
is writing the sort of official, quasi official biography.
Yeah.
We'll get an email from Jennifer. How could you talk about Nico without me on the show? She's very funny. So at this point, we are going to turn the show over to Mark, who's going to tell us about some of the new stuff, the new pieces going to the library.
Yeah, there's just some kind of quite fun stuff. There's an uncredited, it's actually in his own words, Brian Jones for Raven 1964, describing what it's like to play a gig for the Rolling Stones. He says, the atmosphere is more than electric by now. It's something tangible, like a vast elastic band ready to snap at any moment. And then we're off. Keith roars into Talking About You. The curtains slowly part. The Stones are rolling. As our music gains momentum, the kids sway like palm trees in a hurricane. A huge Hampton roar swamps our overworked amplifiers. We feel as if we're really in there with the fans. And so it carries
on. That can't be Brian. No, overworked. I mean, that smacks of Keith Elton.
Yeah. He wrote that?
No, I mean, as Bond
probably
said,
our good friend Keith Elton wrote that.
I strongly suspect... Jeffrey Cannon reviewing Delaney and Bonnie and Friends at the Royal Albert Hall in December 69. And this is when Eric Clapton... Delaney and Bonnie supported Blind Faith on the tour and then broke up, and Eric basically joined Delaney and Bonnie
And stole their whole shit.
Okay.
Sorry, are you going to cut that part out?
No. That's absolutely right. She says, Bonnie Brown glances at Eric Clapton. I can see her feel the glory of the fact that he's playing for her. After years of Tiny Hall's ex-Iket Bonnie, not so long ago singing in bars in San Fernando, is being backed tonight by the most famous and magnetic white guitarist in the world. Yee-ow! She steps back from the microphone, hoists her skirts, skips, laughs, alight with joy. I mean, it's a lovely piece of writing, you know. I mean, what everyone feels about Eric Clapton.
I don't like Eric Clapton. I think he's overrated.
Oh, God, no, I think we would concur with that.
Hashtag overrated.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have recently started, they released a load of Cream, live Cream stuff, as part of these massive reissue series.
Yeah.
A lot, and it's kind of quite compelling as a sort of mad, or neo-psychedelic, you know, power trio noise. But... you know, everything he did after Cream has just been...
He's just like a walking average... This is a horrible thing to say, but I don't care. I will preface it by saying kids don't do drugs. But he's a walking advertisement. What happens when you stop doing heroin, you become fucking boring, man. I'm sorry. Kids don't do drugs.
Kids don't give up heroin.
Yeah, don't give up heroin. Woo!
Moving on to 71, Michael Watts and Melody Maker interviewing Randy Newman. Now, Randy Newman always gives good interview. 71... He hasn't really got... His career is sort of getting going. He'd be making his records, which weren't selling much, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
He'd developing a bit of reputation. But he's great. He says, maybe I get all the rot out, and that's why I'm so lovable and friendly and perfect in every way. Saintly, that's what sums me up. This is love it. Everywhere I've gone, they like me, but I get bored. I'm a manager's nightmare. I guess you can't handle me. In this interview, he's very uncertain about himself, about his place in, the pop world. He had just done a showcase for the industry in some London hotel and had stopped halfway through because everyone was just talking and drinking. He didn't throw a strop. He just obviously thought, why am I here?
I would think you guys, English people from England, would have...
As opposed to English people.
Do you want to take that sentence again?
The English from England. I would think you guys would have a hard time understanding him, not literally understanding what he says, but to me he just seems like so fucking deadpan American.
No. I think actually we get him better than a lot of Americans do. And I'd
because, you see, we get irony.
We get irony.
Yeah.
Hey,
hey, hey. Sufficiently provocative.
Yeah, we get some irony.
But he's all about irony. And he would himself say, not that the English get me more than my far countrymen do, but I think he would lament the fact that a lot of Americans don't get irony. A la, like, short people, rednecks, you know, these songs that got him into huge trouble.
We
because
kind of cranky about shit like that.
Moving to 75, Larry Sloman, who we talked about last week in relation to the Rolling Thunder review. This is, he reported on George Harrison's 75 tour and interviews him, and the tour is really a bit of a disaster. The audiences aren't interested in George's recent album, recent work. They just want the sort of the hits, and the interviews is just really dull because George Harrison's talking sort of kind of, you know, karmic bollocks, basically, you know. Anyway, getting back to karma, I see life as a piece of string, the goal being to try to undo all the knots, you know. And he carries on in this sort of...
That's how you see it, isn't it, Ames?
I'm kind of smacked a bit. I mean, he's dead, you know.
Yeah,
still.
I know. I mean, look, you know, believe that.
I've trashed two Beatles in 45 minutes.
Yeah. Shame we don't have pieces on the others.
No, yeah. I like the Beatles. Yeah. I just want to go on record saying I like the Beatles.
Okay, so
yeah. Well, in case you get some attack.
Yeah, you never know. You never know.
Robert Duncan, second part of Robert Duncan's monumental Kiss piece for Cream 77. And the second half is where he interviews Gene Simmons, who I'm afraid to say actually kind of says some pretty smart stuff.
He's not an idiot, he's just an asshole.
He says, I like platforms. I don't like being 6'1". I like being 6'8", which is kind of fair enough. He says, all those people in New York who are dressing up to look like Lou Reed don't realise in Gary, Indiana, everybody looks like that.
That's a good quote.
which is basically down-dressing, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, so, and no matter how badly somebody wants to tear us apart, they have to print a picture of me. I love that. So basically, you know, any
he's
publicity
a smart
is good
businessman,
yeah.
Gene yes, Simmons, he and he created an amazing brand.
It's pretty good. I mean,
and had a very long tongue.
Yeah. And he's a Republican, though.
Well, he's a Republican.
He always was, really. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. Smash It's 81. Dave Rimmer interviewing Japan. I mean, Mick Kahn's very funny. Japan had started doing really well in Japan. Their first real major market was in Japan. And Mick Kahn says, I can't imagine a band from Japan called England doing very well in this country, in That's England.
There was a heavy metal band in LA during the kind of hair metal years called London. Funnily enough.
Yeah,
but not England.
Yeah, yeah. And they did nothing here.
No.
Nick Kent reviewing the Miners Benefit concert at the Festival Hall in September 84. Which featured as a man of the Style Council and Wham. Now, the thing is that he goes on about how Wham were basically singing over a backing track.
As if that's a bad thing.
Well, this is my very point about this, because this made me fairly angry, because this is Nick Kent being snotty about authenticity, notions of authenticity. Everyone cottoned on in less than a minute that Wham were, in fact, miming to a tape on which four tracks were sequenced. Somewhat oddly, in fact, causing the final humiliation for Wee George when an exclusive print through the new single had to be postponed. And he goes on in this sort of line. He reports George saying his rationale was this: if anyone thinks that Wham miming matters, they aren't here for the right reasons. Now, I think that's spot on. Mm. You know, it really doesn't matter that they're miming. The fact that this ultra-pop band would appear for the Miners at the time of the Miners'
strike
is really significant. And so Nick Kent's been really snotty here, and you know,
white rock critics snotty about pop music.
Well,
what?
No, never before.
What?
The first time it ever happened.
The last one, Spin 1991. Daly.
Stephen Daly.
Stephen Daly.
Former drummer in Orange Juice. Did you know him at all, Stephen?
I knew of.
He's just come on board and
we're
delighted
writing.
To have him.
Yeah.
This is a big interview with De La Soul on the back of their second album, De La Soul is Dead.
Yes.
And they were having a real struggle in that everyone loved the first album. It was
as we call them in the United States, De La.
Sorry, De La.
Excuse me.
God, I'm such a peasant.
De La Soul.
I stand duly corrected.
Yeah.
And
Della is like Della Reese, De La Soul.
But it's French.
I'm just de saying.
De la soul.
De la soul. Long Island. De la soul.
Of the soul.
They've been thrown off the tour with LL Cool J. Oh. Because they've been getting, they and people have been getting into fights around them. And what that was that basically all these hardcore hip hoppers and fans.
Rap fans. We like to call them rap fans.
This is going to be relentless.
She has every right.
She has every
right. Hip-hoppers are like those buses that drive around. Get off the bus.
Hip-hop on,
hip-hop off. Sorry.
And they're being challenged. The people come to their dressing rooms, challenging the fight, because they...
Who, LL's people?
No, other people. Because they saw this band as being somehow thinking they're above... street stuff with all their daisy age. Yeah.
Oh.
And so they said, just because we speak about peace doesn't mean we can't defend ourselves and kick much ass.
That's true. They're from a really kind of shit neighborhood in Long Island.
Yeah, and this is the sort of stuff which influences the second album, that they wanted to undo all the daisy age sort of hippy-dippy image. And also, they sound just really sad that what had started off being huge fun suddenly, really quickly stopped being fun. Back in those days, you could go to a party and just get on the mic. Now, basically, it's just work and rules. It's a pretty downbeat.
They're nice guys. I just saw them actually. They came out with the Gorillaz, and the Gorillaz played in Brooklyn, and they came out, and everybody went. They're nice guys. Yeah. I just thought they were nice.
I'm glad that they got. Even though their record sales kind of fell off a cliff after the
first
album.
Know the reason behind that.
No, I don't.
Okay. Have you guys covered, by the way, the whole Jody Rosen story about the UME, the fires, the Universal Records, all
no,
the
we
masters
haven't.
Going up in flames? Well, that's a whole nother, you know, whatever. De La, Tommy Boy has basically, they didn't want to give, the reason De La stuff has never been released digitally is because they wanted to give him like this insane percentage rate. And so they wouldn't have made any...
But I mean, the sales did... the first album
they fell
was
off.
Huge.
That's why I got asked to review Balloon Mind State, the record. Nobody gave a flying fuck.
I like the fact that, despite the fact their sales have fallen off, they've stayed together pretty much.
Oh, no, and they still make good music.
Yeah, you know, and they've carved out a career over what, however many years it is now. I mean, this is 91, so you can
20-something
do...
20-something years.
20 years, you know. I think that's wholly admirable. Yeah, they've done a lot of stuff I've really liked, you know. So that's my lot. How about you?
Yeah. Okay, so three pieces I just briefly wanted to mention because we are almost out of time. One I absolutely loved is a long piece from the 90s by the late Al Aronowitz, which is essentially about this album that Bob Neuwirth made or was making for David Geffen. Mm-hmm. So it's a piece called A Movie for David Geffen. And it's just an extraordinary piece about this album. Essentially, the album was a result of a bet that Albert Grossman, who was Neuwirth's manager, Neuwirth being Bobby Dylan's, the guy that Bob Dylan based his kind of cruel persona on. And Grossman, Grossman bet David Geffen that he couldn't get Bob Neuwirth to make an album. And so $200,000 later, Geffen ends up with an album on Asylum Records that sells like 10 copies. Mm. And so it's the story of the making of that through mainly the reminiscences of an interesting character called Thomas Jefferson Kay, who was the producer on the album. And it's just a terrific piece about Geffen, you know, Dylan, Bob Neuwirth, and all the stars who were essentially doing coke at the sessions in LA. We lost just a few days ago the great Dave Bartholomew, who really more than anyone was the architect of New Orleans R&B. He was the guy who produced the very early Fats Domino records. And he died at 100 years old.
100 years, that's an innings.
He was 100.
And
so this is a piece Bob Fisher sent us after Dave died. It's just an interesting piece and kind of walk through Dave's career and his own music.
It is astonishing. You know, when we're talking about this in the office, I pulled up his Wikipedia page and your jaw drops a number of fantastic records he was involved in. I mean, just unbelievable.
We talk about Alan Toussaint, don't we? But really, ultimately, if Alan Toussaint was the sort of godfather of New Orleans, then Dave Bartholomew was the grandfather of,
Little Richard probably wouldn't have happened without Dave Bartholomew in many respects. There's all kinds of stuff involved there. It's just amazing, man.
Yeah, so this is kind of marking his departure.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Is that a shame? My tears feel like rain.
And finally, just a great piece by Mick Houghton, who's coming in a couple of weeks to do the podcast. Mick, longtime writer and has written some books recently. He has a new book out called Fried and Justified. This is a piece from 2011 about Terry Reid, who I'm a big fan of. And it's really the story of how Terry Reid missed sort of every boat that he could possibly... missed. Yeah. You know, most famously, he was slated to be the original front man in Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he was signed by Mickey Most. There were so many points at which Terry Reid, one of the great white R&B singers.
Fun fact, Terry Reid is on the last Replacements record.
Is he?
Yeah, okay. He sings Someone Takes the Wheel. Take the Wheel.
Oh, does he?
That's good to know.
We've got an audio interview with him on the site, which is terrific. He tells all these stories about his near misses with such good humour.
Such good grace.
You know, I mean, it's like, you know, I couldn't do Led Zeppelin because actually I'd already agreed to do a tour of ballrooms in England.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
Peter Jay and the Jaywalkers.
The white Alexander O'Neill or something like that.
Something like that. I mean, he's a real sweetheart, actually.
Yeah.
I've met him a couple of times. He's a sweetheart. And he's made some really great records.
Yeah.
This should have been huge. River should have been huge. Seed of Memory, Rogue Waves. There's good records here. And he certainly... I think his second album was called Super Lungs, and he did have this fabulous voice. You know, I saw him play at LA once. He had this Monday night evening thing at the Joint on Pico, and he would have whoever was in town. If it was Robert Plant, everyone would just play with him. I think. And I remember him doing like three or four O.V. Wright songs, and you could sort of understand why he was paying homage to O.V. Wright because his voice. It sort of operates in the same kind of area.
Yeah.
Wonderful, hoarse, ragged, but beautiful white soul voice. So that's it, Terry Reid.
Is it my makeup, another breaker, has it come
to soon? That's us done. Barring, we want to give a shout out to our special guest.
Yes.
She can give her own shout-out.
Yes, because you probably can't read my handwriting or pronounce it.
No, go on. I'm really...
So, because, as my son's friend said, podcasts are the new middle-aged lower back tattoo.
Well, that's certainly why we started one.
Yeah. Shout out, Con Ando. Thank you. So, myself and my friend Courtney Anderson, who's a long-time industry, he's been in the biz, and he's a DJ and a music curator. He's, like, crazy cool. So, we decided to do a podcast because we got shit to say. We're like angry, and he's black and gay, and I'm white and straight. And woo! Intersectionality. Woo! So, a word I had to look up. But anyway, so we have a podcast, and speaking of, we tried to thought of a name, and we're both very New York, and he wanted to call it The Thing Is, and I wanted to call it Not For Nothing, but then we came up with I'ma Let You Finish. Because an homage of came up with the Kanye thing, but also we talk over each other. Anyway, so our Instagram.
We never do that.
Yeah. Our Instagram is I'ma Let You Finish New York. Believe it or not, somebody else said I'ma Let You Finish. So IMMALETU Finish New York, NY. At Twitter, we're Finish I'ma. And we're on Spotify now. I'ma Let You Finish. And it's. But with no spaces in between. So I'ma Let You Finish. We did our first show about Madonna, me basically ensuring I will never get a Madonna ticket in my life.
Oh.
And the new whatever. You know what I mean? Whatever, okay?
Yeah.
Whatever. And our next one, we're just going to... We have a lot... In the United States, as you can imagine, we have lots of things to talk about. But more importantly, the Knicks have just fucking ensured that they're going to have the worst season of all time again. So we're both sports fans, too. So that's my foray into the professional world of...
I'm going to let you finish, but... I'm not going to let you finish.
Yeah.
Is that... So it's just anything to do with, like, New York music?
Culture,
intersectionality,
New York.
The New York Knicks.
No, it's...
Donald
it's,
Trump.
It's just... Yeah. There's a lot going on in the world, obviously.
Yeah.
But there's a lot going on in culture. It's a very intense... I mean, I know you guys are going through your shit, too. but we're Americans, so it's more important. Mm. And no, I mean, we just have sort of like want to vent and talk, and we're both music people, and we set up the Spotify thing so we could play music because we obviously can't afford the licensing. Mm. But we're both really super passionate about music and super passionate about the world, and we're both bored out of our fucking minds, and we need an avenue, and standing on the corner and screaming at people does not seem like a good idea.
Before we wrap up, I got a big thank you to Amy's Makers, because some years back, in fact, it was around the time when you sent us the Amy Winehouse interview, is you sent me an email saying, do you know about this program called The Wire, which hadn't come near England?
Yes,
I instantly hunted it down, and it is simply the best thing.
Did you understand a word they were saying?
Oh yeah,
really?
Well, I tell you what, the great advantage of long form TV like that is you can watch it over and over again.
You get used to.
I watched series 1 through 5.
Because that's a thick act. The Baltimore accent is a hard one.
And you get your ear adjust. It's the second time I watched it through, all the way through, I was getting pretty much everything.
The Wire is such a great show that every one of those actors has gone on to... Idris, of course, has gone on to...
you went a little bit kind of limp
there.
Are you okay?
He's like every... My friend Chris X, who's a brilliant writer, literally like posts pictures of Idris going, damn you, you know.
Yeah.
Every one of those actors, no matter what they do, they are still referred to like Omar. He has a name, obviously, and he's done a million things.
Yeah. But he'll always be Omar.
He'll always be Omar.
It's such a great... I mean, so you sent this email saying, have you ever heard of this program? It hadn't appeared anywhere in England.
So you broke the wire
I broke up Tony. I broke up Tony, and I broke the wire.
You broke up Tony.
I did.
Oh, God. That's, I think, for another podcast.
Okay, for another podcast.
I'm not sure we're ready
But it had nothing to do with, like, creative.
You translate.
It had nothing to do with, like, me going, you know, Raphael, you know, who is really good looking. But it was more... me and Michael Gonzalez, who's also another brilliant writer.
We have him.
Michael's the best. He's one of my best friends.
We love him.
Me trying to asking them why a particular song that was on the advance wasn't on the album, and Raphael just kind of going, I told you that record should have been on, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, he's like, the group broke up.
So you broke them up.
Me and Michael.
Okay.
You're trouble. You know you're no good.
Yes. Me and Michael.
I told you were trouble.
You were just, yes.
All right, so, Mark, talk us out.
Yeah,
sorry,
but we're going to go out with the lovely Bobby Womack talking about this album, which he recorded for Atlantic, and then Pickett did the vocals over. And his wonderful three-word Jerry Wexler impersonation. What a fabulous guest you've been, Amy.
You are a true star.
I'm being overseas. I'm being in England.
Tell all your friends back over the pond.
Huge
you are.
People
now
like me. They just... You know what it is? These kids today running magazines... You know you're in trouble when you pitch an editor of a black music magazine, which will go unnamed, and they go, oh, who's Nana Cherry? And I'm like, first off, motherfucker, you could have been Googling it while you were typing. Number one. And number two, please.
And on that note,
we'll see you next week.
Bye. Thank you, guys. It was really great. Seriously.
Thanks for coming in, Amy. Bon voyage. Bye.
Bye.
I know I've done you wrong. When I drove you away from your home.
Jerry asked me, I said, why, you know, like, yeah, we love Bobby. We love to have him. Whatever you want. But they didn't never believe in me as an artist. And so when Pickett called me, he said, Bobby, they want me to put my voice in your tracks. He said, you know, like, I don't want to do that, man. He said, girl, me and you've been friends of mine. I said, put your voice in my track. He said, what do you mean? I thought they was coming out with the record. He said, no, man, they're trying to tell me to go in the studio and cut it. So I said, okay then, well look man, I said, why don't you go ahead? I said, let me talk to Jerry. I called Jerry. I said, Jerry, when is the record coming out?
It'll be out very soon, baby.
You know, I said, Jerry, I just talked to Wilson, man. I know what's happening. So he said, look, you'll get the writers for it, man. He said, but man, I just don't like your voice, man. I don't know what it is, man. He said, you know. He said, we don't have no Sam Cooks over here. You sound too Sam Cookish. I said, he's 70, so I said... He said, I only took you in the first place because Ed Wright was involved, and I didn't want Ed to be pulling my records off the list, you know. So I said, okay then, man, that's cool. So then Pickett went down and cut I'm in Love and all these songs again.
Yeah, and the strange thing is, when Wilson Pickett cut them, he used the same inflections that you used.
I sung them, and and the tape, track for him, and he sung them word for word exactly the way I would do them, and that's the way he would cut, and I cut him better than anybody did. And then when he stopped, when I stopped, like, giving him any songs, that's when he started to, like, that's fading. Because he didn't have, he had one thing, he had the voice, but you got to have the material. You got to have the material, man. Anytime you got to have someone to write for you.
Saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
That was Bobby Womack in conversation with Cliff White in 1976, concluding this week's Rocks Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Amy Linden. Her podcast, I'ma Let You Finish, all one word, is available on Spotify. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews at rocksbackpages.com.